So we're on a section sort of called doing the gardening and sort of looking after the mind, of course, which takes effort. And the previous sutta reading was introducing the upakilesa, imperfections of mind. And before we go on to the next sutta, which is also on the upakilesas, I'd just sort of like to come back and look at something a bit more basic, and that just sort of our motivation for applying energy, effort. And this sutta sort of follows the kind of classic formula for the four right efforts, but there's a bit of a twist to it, which is interesting. This is Samyutta 16, Sutta number 2. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Venerable Mahakasapa and the Venerable Sariputta were dwelling at Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. Then in the evening, the Venerable Sariputta emerged from seclusion and approached the Venerable Mahakasapa. He exchanged greetings with the Venerable Mahakasapa, and when they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, he sat down to one side and said to him, Friend, it is said that one who is not ardent and who is unafraid of wrongdoing is incapable of enlightenment, incapable of nibbana, incapable of achieving the unsurpassed security from bondage. But one who is ardent and afraid of wrongdoing is capable of enlightenment, capable of nibbana, capable of achieving the unsurpassed security from bondage. In what way is this so, friend? Here, friend, a bhikkhu does not arouse ardor by thinking. If unarisen, evil, unwholesome states arise in me, this may lead to my harm. Nor by thinking, if evil, unwholesome states that have arisen in me already are not abandoned, this may lead to my harm. Nor by thinking, if unarisen wholesome states do not arise in me, this may lead to my harm. Nor by thinking, if wholesome states that have arisen in me cease, this may lead to my harm. Thus he is not ardent. And how, friend, is he unafraid of wrongdoing? Here, friend, a bhikkhu does not become afraid at the thought. If unarisen evil, unwholesome states arise in me, this may lead to my harm. Nor at the thought, if wholesome states that have arisen in me cease, this may lead to my harm. Thus he is unafraid of wrongdoing. It is in this way, friend, that one who is not ardent and who is unafraid of wrongdoing is incapable of enlightenment, incapable of nibbana, incapable of achieving the unsurpassed security from bondage. And how, friend, is one ardent? Here, friend, a bhikkhu arouses ardor by thinking, if unarisen evil, unwholesome states arise in me, this may lead to my harm. And by thinking, if wholesome states that have arisen in me cease, this may lead to my harm. Thus he is ardent. And how, friend, is he afraid of wrongdoing? Here, friend, a bhikkhu becomes afraid at the thought, if unarisen, evil, unwholesome states arise in me, this may lead to my harm. And at the thought, if wholesome states that have arisen in me cease, this may lead to my harm. Thus he is afraid of wrongdoing. It is in this way, friend, that one who is ardent and afraid of wrongdoing is capable of enlightenment, capable of nibbana, capable of achieving the unsurpassed security from bondage. So it's just that sense of recognizing that there's a it's to one's detriment when those things which are unskillful arise and are not abandoned. It's to one's detriment, or if they're those things that haven't arisen and are not protected against, then that's also leads to one's detriment. So that one's sort of effort and energy applied to those recognizing the unskillfulness that does is possible. And that's there was a in the commentaries they talk of the say like the those things which are say the unarisen unwholesome states that arise are like the anusaya, deeper sort of levels of defilement, kilesa, so that there's that sense of these things haven't arisen, or those things which are that have arisen are already they're sort of displaying themselves and they're not abandoned, so that they're that's more understanding more clearly how that leads to one's harm, or those unarisen wholesome states that do not arise is looking to the those factors of the path which are transcendent, and then the wholesome states that have arisen are those things which one can see for oneself that these are a benefit, but then recognizing that they're impermanent and they do cease. To one's dismay sometimes. They're there. So they're putting forth that effort and, towards maintaining that which is wholesome and dealing skillfully with that which is unwholesome. There's a couple of short quotes on the on virya of effort in the Melinda Panha. It says, just as your majesty, a man might shore up a house that was falling down with an extra piece of wood, and being thus shored up, that house would not fall down. Even so, your majesty, virya, effort, has the characteristic of shoring up. Shored up by effort, no skillful dhammas are lost. So that's what that word serves for, propping up the good and the wholesome. And Buddhaghosa in the Visuddhimagga, the term for say the four right efforts is samapadana, and of course there's they love playing with the words, so that padana can sometimes be meant used as effort or endeavor, and then sometimes as what is principal or chief, what is foremost. So Buddhaghosa also provides the following exegesis of the term samapadana. It is padana in that by means of it they endeavor, paddhanti. Samapadana is beautiful padana. So that is samma as both in right or correct or as in beautiful. It's beautiful padana. Either it is samapadana in that by means of it they endeavor rightly, or it is samapadana in that it is beautiful because of forsaking the ugliness of the defilements, and padana because of producing welfare and happiness due to bringing about the state of being best and causing the state of being chief. It is a term for strength. It is fourfold in that it accomplishes the functions of abandoning and non-arising for arisen and unarisen unskillful dhammas, respectively, and the functions of arising and maintenance of unarisen and arisen skillful dhammas, respectively. Therefore, four samapadanas are spoken of. Okay, this next one is the Chula Dukkha Kanda Sutta Majjhima 14, the shorter discourse on the mass of suffering. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country at Kapilavattu in Nigrodha's park. Then Mahanama the Sakyan went to the Blessed One. So Mahanama was a cousin of the Buddha, and as a brother of Aniruddha and Ananda, and he chose to remain a householder and let Aniruddha become a monk. He's also I'll read that after. Then Mahanama the Sakyan went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and said, Venerable Sir, I have long understood the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One thus. Greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Hate is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Delusion is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Yet while I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One thus, at times states of greed, hate, and delusion invade my mind and remain. I have wondered, Venerable Sir, what state is still unabandoned by me internally, owing to which at times these states of greed, hate, and delusion invade my mind and remain. Mahanama was considered to be a Sakadagami. So here you see, and he's been acknowledged by the Buddha, at least in one other place I know of, at least as a Sotapanna, so that he's been acknowledged as somebody who has entered the stream, but then here he is, greed, hate, and delusion coming up in the mind. Why does it keep coming up? Mahanama, there is still a state unabandoned by you internally, owing to which, at times, states of greed, hate, and delusion invade your mind and remain. For were that state already abandoned by you internally, you would not be living the home life. You would not be enjoying sensual pleasures. Even though a noble disciple has seen clearly as it actually is with proper wisdom how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering and much despair, and how great is the danger in them, as long as he still does not attain to the rapture and pleasure that are apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, or to something more peaceful than that, he may still be attracted to sensual pleasures. So that one would need to either be an arahant or an anagami to see that really clearly. But when a noble disciple has seen clearly, as it actually is, with proper wisdom, how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering and much despair, and how great is the danger in them, and he attains to the rapture and pleasure that are apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, or to something more peaceful than that, then he is no longer attracted to sensual pleasures. Before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too clearly saw, as it actually is with proper wisdom, how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering, and much despair, and how great is the danger in them. But as long as I still did not attain to the rapture and pleasure that are apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, or to something more peaceful than that, I recognized that I still could be attracted to sensual pleasures. But when I clearly saw, as it actually is with proper wisdom, how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering and much despair, and how great is the danger in them, and I attained to the rapture and pleasure that are apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, or to something more peaceful than that, I recognized that I was no longer attracted to sensual pleasures. And what is the gratification in the case of sensual pleasures? Mahanama, there are these five chords of sensual pleasures. And it goes through a whole list of things of difficulties that arise through the just conflicts and quarrels and all the complications of the world. Now this too is a danger in the case of sensual pleasures, a mass of suffering in the life to come, having sensual pleasures as its cause, sensual pleasures as its source, sensual pleasures as its basis, the cause being simply sensual pleasures. Now Mahanama, on one occasion I was living at Rajgaha on the mountain Vulture Peak. On that occasion a number of Niguntas living on the Black Rock on the slopes of Isigili were practicing continuous standing, rejecting seats, and were experiencing painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion. So, I mean, that was standard practice for the Niguntas and a lot of the sort of ascetics in India. So the Niguntas or Jains, followers of the teacher Nigunta Nataputta, also known as Mahavira, stress the practice of austerities to wear off the accumulations of past evil karma. The purpose of this passage, according to the commentary, is to show the escape, which was not shown earlier, along with the gratification and the danger in sensual pleasures. The Buddha brings in the Jain practice of asceticism to demonstrate that his own teaching is a middle way, free from the two extremes of sensual indulgence and self-mortification. Then when it was evening, I rose from meditation and went to the Niguntas there. I asked them, "Friends, why do you practice continuous standing, rejecting seats, and experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion?" When this was said, they replied, "Friend, the Niguntha Nataputta is omniscient and all-seeing and claims to have complete knowledge and vision thus. Whether I am walking or standing or asleep or awake, knowledge and vision are continuously and uninterruptedly present to me." He says thus, "Niguntas, you have done evil actions in the past. Exhaust them with the performance of piercing austerities. And when you are here and now restrained in body, speech, and mind, that is, doing no evil actions for the future. So by annihilating with asceticism past actions, and by doing no fresh actions, there will be no consequence in the future. With no consequence in the future, there is the destruction of action. With the destruction of action, there is the destruction of suffering. With the destruction of suffering, there is the destruction of feeling. With the destruction of feeling, all suffering will be exhausted. This is the doctrine we approve of and accept, and we are satisfied with it." When this was said, I told them, "But friends, do you know that you existed in the past, and that it is not the case that you did not exist?" "No, friend." "But friends, do you know that you did evil actions in the past, and did not abstain from them?" "No, friend." "But friends, do you know that you did such and such evil actions?" "No, friend." "But friends, do you know that so much suffering has already been exhausted, or that so much suffering has still to be exhausted, or that when so much suffering has been exhausted, all suffering will have been exhausted?" "No, friend." "But friends, do you know what the abandoning of unwholesome states is, and what the cultivation of wholesome states is here and now?" "No, friend." "So, friends, it seems that you do not know that you existed in the past, and that it is not the case that you did not exist, or that you did evil actions in the past and did not abstain from them, or that you did such and such evil actions, or that so much suffering has already been exhausted, or that so much suffering has still to be exhausted, or that when so much suffering has been exhausted, all suffering will have been exhausted, or what the abandoning of unwholesome states is, and what the cultivation of wholesome states is here and now. That being so, those who are murderers, bloody-handed evildoers in the world, when they are reborn among human beings, go forth into homelessness as Niguntas. Friend Gotama, pleasure is not to be gained through pleasure. Pleasure is to be gained through pain. For were pleasure to be gained through pleasure, then King Sainya Bimbisara of Magadha would gain pleasure, since he abides in greater pleasure than the Venerable Gotama. Surely the Venerable Niguntas have uttered those words rashly and without reflection. Rather, it is I who ought to be asked, who abides in greater pleasure, King Sainya Bimbisara of Magadha or the Venerable Gotama? Surely, friend Gotama, we uttered those words rashly and without reflection, but let that be. Now we ask the Venerable Gotama, who abides in greater pleasure, King Sainya Bimbisara of Magadha or the Venerable Gotama? Then, friends, I shall ask you a question in return. Answer it as you like. What do you think, friends? Can King Sainya Bimbisara of Magadha abide without moving his body or uttering a word, experiencing the peak of pleasure for 7 days and nights? No, friend. Can King Sainya Bimbisara of Magadha abide without moving his body or uttering a word, experiencing the peak of pleasure for 6, 5, 4, 3, or 2 days and nights, for 1 day and night? No, friend. But friends, I can abide without moving my body or uttering a word, experiencing the peak of pleasure for 1 day and night, for 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 days and nights, for 7 days and nights. What do you think, friends? That being so, who dwells in greater pleasure, King Sainya Bimbisara of Magadha or I? That being so, the Venerable Gotama abides in greater pleasure than King Sainya Bimbisara of Magadha. That is what the Blessed One said. Mahanama the Sakyan was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that the sense of not all pleasure is to be shunned, but that which stirs up greed, hatred, and delusion is, from the Buddhist perspective, what is to be relinquished. Any questions? Okay, this continuing with this theme of doing the gardening, putting work into what needs to be attended to. This is Anguttara 5, Sutta 144. In the Tikandaki Grove near Saketa, the Blessed One said, monks, it is good for a monk, one, to abide from time to time, perceiving the attractive in the unattractive. Two, to abide from time to time, perceiving the unattractive in the attractive. Three, to abide from time to time, perceiving the attractive in the unattractive as well as in the attractive. Four, to abide from time to time, perceiving the unattractive in the attractive as well as in the unattractive. Five, to reject both the attractive and the unattractive, and to abide in equanimity, mindful and clearly comprehending. One, but for what reason should a monk abide perceiving the attractive in the unattractive? He should do so with the thought, may no lust arise in me for lust-inducing objects. Two, and for what reason should he abide perceiving the attractive in the unattractive? He should do so with the thought, may no hatred arise in me towards hate-inducing objects. Three, and for what reason should he abide perceiving the unattractive in the attractive as well as the unattractive? He should do so with the thought, may no lust arise in me for lust-inducing objects, and may no hatred arise in me towards hate-inducing objects. Four, and for what reason should he abide perceiving the attractive in the unattractive as well as in the attractive? He should do so with the thought, may no hatred arise in me towards hate-inducing objects, and may no lust arise in me for lust-inducing objects. Five, and for what reason should he reject both the unattractive and the attractive and abide in equanimity, mindful and clearly comprehending? He should do so with the thought, in any situation, anywhere and to any extent, may lust never arise in me for lust-inducing objects, nor hatred towards hate-inducing objects, nor delusion towards objects liable to cause delusion. There's a footnote on that. Say the practice here described is called Arliya Iti, or the noble magic, or the power of the noble ones. It is a kind of subtle magic of transformation by which habitual emotional attitudes can be changed at will or replaced by equanimity. In its perfection, this practice is only produced in noble ones who have reached mind mastery. But the commentary emphasizes that those of lesser attainments as well can and should practice it, if they are experienced in insight meditation and have keen intelligence. Insight meditation is helpful in this respect, as it teaches us to distinguish between the facts of an experience and the emotive or other reactions to them. With keen intelligence, one can become aware of the possibility of emotive responses other than the habitual ones, and of the possibility of withholding any such responses. This next sutta is Majjhima 20, the Vitakka Santana Sutta, the removal of distracting thoughts. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied, "the Blessed One said this, 'Bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is pursuing the higher mind, from time to time he should give attention to five signs.' What are the five? 'Here, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign, and owing to that sign there arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should give attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome. When he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Just as a skilled carpenter or his apprentice might knock out, remove, and extract a coarse peg by means of a fine one, so too, when a bhikkhu gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated." If, while he is giving attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should examine the danger in those thoughts. Thus, these thoughts are unwholesome, they are reprehensible, they result in suffering. When he examines the danger in those thoughts, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Just as a man or a woman, young, youthful, and fond of ornaments, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being were hung around his or her neck, so too, when a bhikkhu examines the danger in those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. If, while he is examining the danger in those thoughts, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should try to forget those thoughts and should not give attention to them. When he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied, internally quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Just as a man with good eyes who did not want to see forms that had come within range of sight would either shut his eyes or look away, so too, when a bhikkhu tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. If, while he is trying to forget those thoughts and is not giving attention to them, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should give attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts. The commentary in Pali it's vitakka sankhara santanam. So it's takes the compound to mean stopping the cause of the thought. This is accomplished by inquiring, when an unwholesome thought has arisen, what is its cause? What is the cause of its cause? Such an inquiry, according to the commentary, brings about a slackening and eventually the cessation of the flow of unwholesome thought. So he should give attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts. When he gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Just as a man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? And he would walk slowly. Then he might consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand? And he would stand. Then he might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit? And he would sit. Then he might consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? And he would lie down. By doing so, he would substitute for each grosser posture one that was subtler. So too, when a bhikkhu gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. If, while he is giving attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. When with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain and crush him, so too, when with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, a bhikkhu beats down, constrains and crushes mind with mind, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign, and owing to that sign, there arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then when he gives attention to some other sign, connected with what is wholesome, any such evil, unwholesome thoughts are abandoned in him and subside. And with the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. When he examines the danger in those thoughts, when he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, when he gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, when with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind, any such evil, unwholesome thoughts are abandoned in him, and his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. This bhikkhu is then called a master of the courses of thought. He will think whatever thought he wishes to think, and he will not think any thought that he does not wish to think. He has severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with the complete penetration of conceit, he has made an end of suffering. This is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Questions on that? Next one is from Anguttara 5, Sutta 161. Sariputta giving advice on how to remove ill will and grudges. There are, O monks, five ways of getting rid of a grudge, by means of which a monk can remove all grudges that have arisen within him. What five? If a grudge arises towards any person, then one should cultivate loving kindness towards him. One should cultivate compassion towards him. One should cultivate equanimity towards him. In that way, one can remove the grudge towards that person. Say the third way is, or one should pay no attention to him and give no thought to him. In that way, one can remove the grudge. Or one may apply to that person the fact of ownership of kamma. This worthy person is the owner of his actions, the heir of his actions. His actions are the womb from which he has sprung, his relations and his protection. Whatever he does, good or bad, he will be the heir to that. These are the five ways of getting rid of a grudge, by means of which a monk can remove all grudges that have arisen within him. Okay. The next sutta is Anguttara 7, sutta number 58. It's dealing with drowsiness. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling in the Bhaga country, near the town of Susumaragiri, in the deer park at the base of Kala Grove. On that occasion, the Venerable Mahamoggallana, dwelling in Magadha, near the village of Kalavalamutta, was nodding in his seat. The Blessed One saw this with the divine eye, purified and superhuman. Having seen this, he vanished from the deer park at the base of Kala Grove, and as speedily as a strong man might stretch his bent arm or bend his stretched arm, he appeared before the Venerable Mahamoggallana. The Blessed One sat down on the seat prepared for him and said to the Venerable Mahamoggallana, "Are you nodding, Moggallana? Are you nodding?" "Yes, Lord." "Well then, Moggallana, at whatever thought drowsiness befalls you, you should not give attention to that thought. Then, by doing so, it is possible that your drowsiness will vanish. But if, by doing so, your drowsiness does not vanish, then you should ponder the Dhamma as you have learnt it and mastered it. You should examine it and investigate it closely in your mind. Then, by doing so, it is possible that your drowsiness will vanish. But if, by doing so, your drowsiness does not vanish, then you should recite in detail the Dhamma as you have learnt it and mastered it. Then, by doing so, it is possible that your drowsiness will vanish. But if by doing so your drowsiness does not vanish, then you should pull both earlobes and rub your limbs with your hand. Then by doing so it is possible that your drowsiness will vanish. But if by doing so your drowsiness does not vanish, you should get up from your seat, and after washing your eyes with water, you should look around in all directions and upwards to the stars and constellations. Then by doing so it is possible that your drowsiness will vanish. But if by doing so your drowsiness does not vanish, then you should attend to the perception of light, resolve upon this perception of daytime, as by day, so at night, as at night, so by day. Thus, with an open and unencumbered heart, you should develop a luminous mind. Then by doing so, it is possible that your drowsiness will vanish. But if by doing so your drowsiness does not vanish, then, with your senses turned inward and your mind not straying outward, you should take to walking up and down, being aware of going to and fro. Then by doing so, it is possible that your drowsiness will vanish. But if by doing so, your drowsiness does not vanish, then, mindful and clearly comprehending, you may lie down, lion-like, on your right side, placing one foot on the other, keeping in mind the thought of rising. And on awakening, you should quickly get up, thinking, I must not indulge in the pleasure of resting and reclining, in the pleasure of sleep. Thus, Moggallana, should you train yourself. Further, Moggallana, you should train yourself by thinking. You should think, when calling at families on the alms round, I shall not be given to pride. Thus should you train yourself. For in families it may happen that people are busy with work and may not notice that a monk has come. Then a monk, if given to pride, may think, who, I wonder, has estranged me from this family? These people seem to be displeased with me. Thus, by not receiving alms food from them, he is perturbed. Being perturbed, he becomes excited. Being excited, he loses self-control. And if he is uncontrolled, his mind will be far from concentration. Further, Moggallana, you should train yourself in this way. I shall not speak contentious talk. Thus should you train yourself. If there is contentious talk, there is sure to be much wordiness. With much wordiness, there will be excitement. He who is excited will lose self-control, and if he is uncontrolled, his mind will be far from concentration. I do not, Moggallana, praise all companionship, nor do I blame all companionship. I do not praise companionship with monks and layfolk, but companionship with dwellings where there are few sounds and little noise, which are fanned by cool breezes, remote from human habitation, suitable for seclusion. This do I praise. After these words, the Venerable Mahamoggallana said to the Blessed One, in what way, Lord, can it be explained briefly how a monk is liberated through the elimination of craving? One who has reached the final end, the final security from bondage, the final holy life, the final consummation, and is foremost among devas and humans. Here, Moggallana, a monk has learnt this. Nothing is fit to be clung to. That's that phrase, sambhedam manalam apinivesaya. Nothing is to be clung to, nothing is to be attached to. If a monk has learnt that nothing is fit to be clung to, he directly knows everything. By directly knowing everything, he fully understands everything. When he fully understands everything, whatever feeling he experiences, be it pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, in regard to those same feelings, he dwells contemplating impermanence, contemplating dispassion, contemplating cessation, contemplating relinquishment. When he thus abides, contemplating impermanence, dispassion, cessation, and relinquishment, in regard to those feelings, he does not cling to anything in the world. Without clinging, he is not agitated. Being unagitated, he personally attains Nibbana. He understands, destroyed his birth, the holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more for this world. That, Moggallana, briefly put, is how a monk is liberated through the elimination of craving. One who has reached the final end, the final security from bondage, the final holy life, the final consummation, and is foremost among devas and humans. And Moggallana was, it wasn't long after that, that he was enlightened. Okay, the commentary says, this discourse served Moggallana as practical advice for overcoming drowsiness as well as an instruction on insight. After he had, by following this very discourse, strengthened insight within himself, he attained arahantship. And that occurred 1 week after his ordination. I've always found this sutta very interesting, both because of the practicality of the, say, direct ways of dealing with the drowsiness, but then it's considered part of the whole piece that that it's not just the drowsiness in meditation, but it's also okay. How are you relating to your holy life as a as a bhikkhu, how do you relate to sort of the relationship with the lay community? What sort of contacts and speech is one involved at? What kind of friends is one keeping? What are the those are all sort of the you know, where are you hanging out, who are you hanging out with? Now those are all basic foundations, and then and then the Buddha goes on after being questioned for the aspects of insight.
Okay.